Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. As you guys know, one of my favorite topics is deep tech, a category that includes quantum science, space tech, energy, advanced manufacturing, and clean tech. If the US is going to outcompete and win against its rivals in the 21st century, it's key that we build the ecosystems and innovation engines necessary to do so. My guest today, Adam Hammer, is co-founder and president of Roadrunner Venture Studios, a new fund working to do just that. In this conversation, we discuss the deep tech revolution, the stakes involved, and how Roadrunner is taking a unique venture studio approach to partnering with founders, scientists, and researchers to launch and build new companies, first in New Mexico, but eventually across the country. A particular reason why I'm so interested in this space is that there's clearly so much work to be done, but also clear opportunity ahead. Instead of an episode bemoaning how we lost our way when it comes to letting the legacy of our dominance in the mid-20th century go away, Adam and I are focused on how we can actually build in this next stage. If you're interested, please reach out to Adam and the Roadrunner Studios crew. Huge thank you to the Foundation for American Innovation for supporting the work of this podcast. Hope you all enjoy the conversation. Adam Hammer, welcome to The Realignment.
Hi, Marshall. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, it's great to chat with you, especially ahead of a really exciting launch that gets to a lot of the core issues that listeners of this podcast are obsessed with. So how about you just kind of start by introducing yourself, your background, and what led you to getting involved with Roadrunner?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. So I'm the co-founder and president of Roadrunner Venture Studios. And I really take my story back to living abroad for a lot of years. So I was born in Houston, in Texas, meaningful because you're wearing a UT shirt at the moment, and born in Houston, but really lived most of my life abroad. So, spent time in Indonesia and Southeast Asia and North Africa and in the Middle East. And the reason why I mention it is moving around and starting anew is a little bit like a founder's journey. Everywhere you go, you build a new community, you think through who you might be. And part of that has, I think, been instructive as I've thought through where I wanted to spend my career and what I wanted to build. So spent a lot of time abroad and came back to the United States for college, went to Wake Forest, and then left Wake Forest to join Goldman Sachs in investment banking. Really gave me a lot of the kind of early education on how companies think about markets, how they think about building new things in the world, what the trade-offs that executives make. And really, I think the early introduction into commercialization. How do you build something that can scale? How do you leverage capital markets to build something in the world? And took those experiences to grad school, and then ultimately ended up at Schmidt Futures, which is a venture facility for public benefit, started by Eric Schmidt as he left Google. Was there for a few years, served as head of strategy and managing director. And I think the thing that I took away from Schmidt Futures, and still very good friends with a lot of the folks that are involved and have been a part of Schmidt Futures, is, you know, their mission was to bet on people, products, and ideas that could change the world. So that was kind of the first seeding for me to think through groundbreaking science and technology and saying, what could we do to de-risk those early insights and really crowd in other funders, whether they be the government or private sponsors or, you know, using capital markets, but how could we find ideas, de-risk them, and really help them scale? Took those experiences to a place called Crypt, where I was our chief operating officer, overseeing product, revenue, business strategy. That was a post-quantum encryption and quantum hardware business. Left there at the recruitment of folks like Gilman Louie and Jordan Blaschek and Steve Weinstein at AFF to help co-found Roadrunner Venture Studios. And what we do is pretty simple, and I think it's pretty unique. We partner with scientists, innovators, engineers to build disruptive businesses. And we do it in places and in communities around America that have been underleveraged, that we think are ripe for economic returns. And we feel like there are partners there locally that have all the building blocks to let us build, you know, next generation companies for America.
Yeah, so many different things here. Let's start by focusing on language, because if a listener doesn't work in venture, tech, startups, et cetera, we could say things like venture studio, and it all kind of seems like the same thing, but the key part of the thesis here is it's really not. So I had a lot of VCs on the podcast before. We've had Mark Andreessen, Keith Raboy of Founders Fund, David Sachs of the All In podcast, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. They are in traditional venture capital. What is the difference between a traditional venture capital firm and the venture studio model that y'all are building in?
It's a great question. So, you know, I think of venture capital in maybe three or four different iterations. So there are, to your point, traditional VC funds. There are accelerators, there are incubators, and there are studios. Let's start with maybe the traditional venture fund, which is, you know, a capital partner, right? They'll provide strategic capital, they'll write companies checks, they'll take a small ownership stake, they'll help catalyze that company, coach the founder. Sometimes they'll take a board seat, but primarily it's about capital and investing. Then you've got accelerators, which are in generally cohorts. So think like, you know, Techstars or Y Combinators. And it's usually a, call it a 10 to 12 week program that, you know, culminates in a demo day. You're building alongside them. It's very cohort based. They share your idea and the company that you're helping build with a variety of VC funds. And then there are things like incubators, which are similar to accelerators, but, you know, really what they focus on are providing shared resources and space, but very rarely do they provide capital. And the venture studio model is unique. I think of it like a, you know, idea factory. We are building businesses from the ground up. And what we're doing is at the earliest stage. So think about an idea that's nothing but, you know, a scribble on a whiteboard or something on the back of a napkin. We'll take that concept, nothing more than a concept. Maybe sometimes it's a research insight. We'll partner with the scientist or engineer or entrepreneur, and we'll take it from concept to company. And what that means is all the services from, you know, providing, helping build the minimum viable product to thinking through product market fit and early customers to building the team. So sometimes it's mapping it to co-founders, mapping it to entrepreneurs that can help it scale while also providing capital. So venture studios are really a company creating foundry that provide everything from capital to team to sometimes first customer. And we take all the, I think, best components of what accelerators and incubators do, but also do what venture funds do, and that will provide that first check as well.
And we're obviously going to keep focusing on language, because when you said idea factory, you bring to mind Bell Labs. I've got the book somewhere back here. I'd love for you, as much as you can, because you're obviously not a historian, you're focused on the actual company side of things, I'd love for you to talk about like the legacy of like 20th century, mid-century, early Cold War idea factories, and how what Roadrunner is focused on, what your work for, how it fits within that tradition.
It's a great question, and it's one that we think a lot about at Roadrunner, because the truth is, to your point, a lot of you know, early innovation in this country happened at corporate labs like Bell Labs and Xerox and DuPont. And you know, I had the pleasure of visiting Bell Labs recently, and it's an incredibly historic place. I mean, you are walking through the cradle of American innovation, and they you know, have done a lot for this country, particularly in that Cold War era, to develop a lot of early technologies. And what we're doing is saying, well, you know, today the landscape for innovation looks a little bit different. That's because of a variety of things like capital markets. That's because of the maybe increased focus for companies to be really mission driven. And what I mean by that, when I say that, is that, you know, there is less perhaps appreciation for experiments that are not exactly accretive to the bottom line. There's more focus on capital markets and shareholders to make sure that all the dollars spent are directly targeted toward the business and its business model. And so I think corporate labs have been under a lot of pressure. And what we've seen is places like Bell and Xerox and others are facing just a very different landscape. And so what's taken place, in my opinion, and I think this is quite an, you know, fundamental to the Roadrunner thesis, is that, you know, a lot of research insights are happening at universities. Frankly, it's one of America's superpowers, is that we have some of the best R&D institutions and R&D talent in the world. That's happening at university labs, national labs, and also corporate labs. But what's happening is they're becoming kind of increasingly separated from customer use cases. Turns out, you know, converting insight to product is really, really hard. And the beauty, the magic of places like Bell Labs, was that it all collided in one place. You had amazing researchers doing things that were sure, you know, mission-driven for the company, but also sometimes experimental. Let researchers have a little bit of a mandate to experiment and take things further beyond necessarily the confines of the product line of the business. But inherently, they were kind of married to a customer, right? I mean, corporations have a superpower in that they understand a customer and their problem sets. And what we've seen is we need more places that combine amazing researchers, like what you see at Bell Labs, like what you see at Los Alamos and various universities across the country, and also combine that with folks that have an understanding of what are the big, hard problems that are commercializable, not just today, but in the next 2, 3, 4 years. Because I think converting insight to product is the combination of amazing research and customer problems. And the Venture Studio is focused on being just that, partnering with researchers, scientists, engineers, looking through and evaluating technology across all of our labs, but then connecting it to real commercializable concepts and problems that customers so badly need solved.
So let's take a zoom out and focus on the broader domestic and frankly, geopolitical situation that Roadrunner is really jumping into, in the sense that if we're talking about Bell Labs, like these models of success from the 1950s and 1960s, you could not divorce them from the Cold War. So I'd love for you to kind of give a story so far. How would you describe the moment we're in from a China perspective, from a focus on domestic manufacturing and innovation perspective? Like, where are we right now as a country?
I think we're at a crossroads. And I think that we're at a moment where the stakes feel very high. And those who are following innovations and emerging tech and that are in these conversations every day see it. But the mission for us is to figure out how to make sure that message applies to a lot of people around this country and a lot of communities that say, okay, well, what's in it for me? And I think back to some of the comments I can remember that Jake Sullivan has made. Perhaps it was in an Atlantic article or in something else where he explained, you know, he was at an event in Iowa and somebody was talking about the neoliberal world order. And they said, well, you know, what the heck is that? And what does that have to do with me? You know, I think part of what this country has failed to do in recent years is think about how to articulate why Americans, why communities should care about things like the neoliberal world order or the rules-based system. It's abstract. And frankly, you know, a lot of communities outside of DC don't care. But the truth is we're at a moment where the stakes are very high. We are developing technologies that I think have the potential to shape the human experience for decades. And I think that the stakes are high in that the country, the society, the communities that take the lead on developing these, that develop the rules of the road, that you know, start to create the scale and start to create the first products will dictate the values that are implicit in those. And, you know, I think the missing piece for the United States, and in particular, you know, I think a lot about our innovation engine is how do we make sure that Americans in places like Albuquerque and Fort Worth and Fargo care about this global competition? And I think there's a few ways to frame it. And if I were to tell the story, I'd say, you know, one is to say that this is fundamentally about economic growth. It's about communities and it's about jobs. So the society, the country, the corporations, the innovators that end up winning, meaning developing some of these early insights, scaling them quickly, you know, that's often where a lot of the economic returns will go. And, you know, there's a lot of positive externalities in communities around America if we can help seed and scale those companies here. And I think it's, you know, it's not only about securing America in this kind of global competitive race for critical tech, it's also about delivering economic returns to those communities beyond those in New York and San Francisco. And it's also about values. We have values that are enshrined in our Constitution, and they're enshrined in our culture, they're enshrined in our community and in our people. And to the extent that we want those to last, to the extent that we want those to be embedded and implicit in things like artificial intelligence and genome sequencing and digital twins, it means that we have to be aggressive about investing here, making sure we seed those companies, make sure we give the support to those companies, and make sure that, you know, we help craft those rules of the road in the same way we did in the post-World War II era. We're going to need new global institutions and new systems. And it's integral and it's critical for the United States at this moment to be leading on those things.
And what are those critical technologies?
Several. So I'd say, you know, maybe most obviously at the moment, artificial intelligence is, you know, I think the emergence of ChatGPT is something that folks that have been following the space have been, you know, realizing has been coming. But for a lot of consumers, this has been their first experience seeing, you know, the magic of AI, right? Oh my gosh, it can write, you know, my research paper. Oh my gosh, it can take a large, complicated concept and break it down for me. Artificial intelligence is shaping our fundamental experience and will continue to. We are just at the beginning of what I think will be a pretty exponential curve of development. I think it's also around synthetic biology. The things that we're able to do in biology and in materials science, I mean, we can basically create any material today. And that's an immense power for humanity to think about, wow, if we can create any material, we can make anything out of anything. We can isolate all the, you know, restrictions of physics and otherwise that have, you know, somewhat restricted humanity previously in creating planes and cars and tissues. And I think that's going to have a tremendous impact on the human experience, on biology, on even the creation of new products, think like polymers and what have you. I also think, you know, at the fundamental level, we've talked a lot about national security. We've learned that semiconductors are at the foundation of a lot of these technologies, that it's not just the things that are built on top, but a lot of what we do at Roadrunner is thinking about the foundational tech, the platform tech. And it's not just software, it's hardware, right? It's semiconductors that are, again, kind of the nucleus of a lot of the technologies that we're talking about in AI. And so it's critical. It's critical we keep those in the country. It's critical we have an industry here in the United States. And it's critical that not only Silicon Valley, but also the government be paying a keen attention to it.
I think a question that comes to mind would be, at a core level, if you're looking at Roadrunner and the Venture Studio, I think of a lot of the 2000s and 2010s playbooks in the startup space. So think of, and for listeners, I recommend you check out like Paul Graham's essays.
Oh yeah.
So, you know, Paul Graham is the founder of Y Combinator, and he's also just a really great writer. And he just writes about how if it's 2009, you should be thinking about think of a problem you have and like work to solve that problem. Or he uses this example of like, actually just like go talk to users, especially in that first year. And he gives the example of the Collison brothers who founded Stripe, which is a payment processing system that powers this podcast, actually, amongst most other things on the internet. They would just walk around San Francisco, like coffee shops, saying like, hey, like, here's our product. What do you think? Right. The essay is called Do Things That Don't Scale. I'm curious, given both the stakes, the heavy investment required, and just the unique founder profile that we're talking about, what does a new playbook for these categories look like? Because in these categories we're discussing today, there's no example of bootstrapping your way through coffee shops saying, hey, this looks kind of crappy right now, but what if we did X, Y, and Z? So what do you think the actual playbook is going to look like as you continue to build out in this space?
Well, I'll say, you know, one of the key aspects that we think about in this playbook is that we fundamentally believe that a lot of the disruptive products and companies to be built in this new era will be born in the lab, will be born at the hands of researchers, will be born at universities and national labs. And frankly, we believe that, you know, again, this country leads the world in research and development and its institutions, but we are not doing enough to harness those key insights. You know, it turns out finding undiscovered science or technological breakthroughs is rare, but it's worth doing, and it requires a different playbook. So our playbook is to partner with scientists. What does it actually mean? It means going into the labs, evaluating technology, partnering with them to think about what is the generalizable insight. So yes, we have a tech that's focused around a specific research use case, but what is novel? What is the technical breakthrough that's implicit in that insight? And can it be applied to a bigger market? Can it be applied to solve a bigger, harder problem, whether it's for the government and the Department of Defense or for a customer or a client? And can we extract that generalizable insight from the lab and actually build a breakthrough company around it? So step one is be in the backyard, partner with these scientists, think about that generalizable insight, and then do a lot of work to de-risk that lab tech. So if we harken back to our conversation about Bell Labs, the beauty there was you were colliding research insights and breakthrough with customers and customer problems. Our playbook takes that by finding that generalizable insight and then making sure that we map it to a burning problem. So what is a problem that either somebody in the world is having and will kind of, you know, will grab it out of your hands if you propose a solution? That problem may be something existing today, but I think critical here, Marshall, when we think about emerging and critical tech, it could also be a problem that's manifesting in the next 3, 4, 5 years. Mm-hmm. So this takes a playbook where we are constantly in conversations with companies, we're constantly in conversation with governments and thinking about what are the problems you face today? How might we extrapolate what those problems might look like in the future? And what new born problems might happen in 2025, 2027. And then actually build a business model around it. So the playbook there is to think about, you know, what is product market fit look like? What can we do to de-risk that concept across at least 3 or 4 metrics? So certainly technology readiness level, which is what a lot of the labs use today, I mean, developed by NASA. And I think one key heuristic for us, but the others are, you know, we try to do work along at customer readiness level. So when will this be ready to be adopted by a customer, used by a customer? In investor readiness level, back to, you know, some of the lessons I learned at places like Schmidt Futures, you know, we need other funders involved. We need scale from capital markets, which means a lot of the early concepts in the labs, you need to build things around it so that they're actually ready for the next investor. That means finding the right team. That means oftentimes coupling the brilliant scientist with the CEO. That means, you know, building the billion-dollar brand around that business so that it's ready for Series A. It's beyond lab tech. It's actually an aspiring company. And third, it's you know, around team readiness level. So we've got, how do we prepare them for investors? How do we prepare them for customers? How do we prepare them to build a team? You know, good startups know that early teams are groups of co-conspirators. And what you have to do is find the people in the companies that eliminate some risk. So if you have the brilliant scientist, you might need the person that knows how to build the revenue model. If you've got the brilliant operator, you might need somebody who's a visionary. And we try to kind of fill out the teams in our playbook by, you know, having our own head of talent who runs an executive search across the country to say, who is best to lead this materials company? Who's best to build this vaccine dehydration company? That playbook across kind of customer readiness, investor readiness, team readiness is integral, I think, to a lot of the de-risking that has to happen out of lab tech, which again is unique to your point, Marshall, than from investing in software companies, because, you know, hardware has high R&D costs. It's hard to iterate and pivot. And it's going to take a de-risking platform out of the lab to help build something around it so that it actually has the contours and the vision of being a disruptive company.
You know, something we're clearly dancing around is the role of the scientist in the company creation process and the management thereof, separate from the innovation. Because if we're thinking of this 2000s and 2010s insight, if you're comparing the 1990s to that next period, which we're emerging from, a critical insight was, hey, it turns out that a undergrad at Stanford who can code, who's an engineer, actually could build a unicorn. And we don't have to treat this like the 1990s, where you basically, as a VC, your job is to get them out of the gate. Then you bring in the professional CEO with like the button-up shirt and the oversized khakis. That model was kind of thrown out. To some success in some cases and a lot of lack of success in other cases. But that's kind of the story I would tell if we were doing this podcast in 2014. In the case of the scientists then, to what degree is the Stanford undergrad insight accurate? So like is it possible that you could have a model where you discover these scientists that are not only brilliant, but also more than capable managers and are actually capable of scaling these companies? I would love just to hear you like think through the shifting dynamics, because there are aspects of this that are true in both respects.
Absolutely. It is possible. And in fact, I think a lot of the scientists we partner with have all the makings of a founder with just the right amount of coaching and the right amount of services. So the way I think about this and the paradigm that's shifted is why I think the venture studio model is right for this moment, which is to say, if our key assumption is that more and more critical technologies and disruptive companies will be born out of the labs, out of the hands of researchers and scientists across this country, we need a unique set of services. We need a unique formula and playbook that is, in my opinion, more hands-on and that fills in some of the gaps around business and product. The key assumption here as well is that there is a really meaningful distinction between technology and product. Technology doesn't change the world. Products change the world. And what that means is that the venture studio needs to be able to productize key insights. It needs to build around that scientist. Some scientists have all the makings of a CEO. Many don't. And if they don't, then you need to do a mapping exercise. You need to do a matchmaking, right? We need to find the right co-founder to put around that scientist so that the scientists can do the thing in the world that they're best at, which is continuing to de-risk the technology, continuing to make and extrapolate that insight and map it to somebody who actually knows how to run the business, think through the customer, the fundraise and the building of the company. But all to say, I think if we look at that kind of early, let's say that software model of almost the Y Combinator paradigm, let's give smart young people coming out of Stanford a check and just let them iterate. It doesn't necessarily apply in the same ways, because we think that in the hardware space, you need more capital. In the lab space, you're going to need more support for the scientist. And I think, frankly, the necessary de-risking, because it's so hard to pivot, right? And in software, you can say, okay, we thought we were going to do this and we're going to pivot quickly. Well, it turns out when you're creating an advanced manufacturing company, pivoting is hard. So finding product market fit takes time and it takes a lot of work. It takes an engine, if you will, behind that scientist. So, maybe we lived in a world where there was sort of the lean startup method that was popular, and certainly we ascribed to aspects of it, but there's also a component of the fat startup method, if you will, that I think is
it doesn't roll off the tongue. And I'm not sure you're not going to be able to publish a best-selling book off of that, but please go on.
No, you're certainly not. But, I think the key there is it's going to take more resources. It's going to take a platform that de-risks around lab tech. It's not lightweight in the ways that software is inherently, but I'll tell you, it's worth doing because, again, I think this is the bedrock of the foundational companies that we'll build in this decade that will take off from here. And I think not only shape, the human experience, but I think are integral to American competitiveness and to national security.
And something I want to highlight, because I think listeners who aren't as keyed in may have missed something. When you were explaining the need to provide buy-in for communities as a part of this broader technological competition, I think a lot of people will hear that and hear part of the argument, which is really like, this has to be a shared project. We have to do this, and that. But I also think there's a more than pragmatic argument. There's an actual argument that there's a lot of talent. There's a lot of energy. You could actually increase the size of the pie through investing across the country. I've had Steve Case on to discuss this thesis himself. So especially considering the New Mexico focus, I'd love to hear what y'all have learned from that process, because I think part of the problem in this space is that there were a lot of efforts in the 2010s to kind of do this, and the record's kind of mixed. So at a long-term level, I think broadly, a lot of the efforts weren't just hyper-concentrated in these critical technologies. So they were also more of the traditional venture model. They're focused on SaaS and traditional companies. So obviously this is different in your case, but I'd love to hear just what y'all have learned by like focusing on like the New Mexico ecosystem so far.
Well, I'll tell you, there's at least three things we've learned. One is we had this early thesis as we created Roadrunner that, great ideas are equally distributed across the country, but opportunity is not. And to say that in a more analytical way, we ran models. We actually did research and thinking through what are the institutions and what are the communities that are that they are a part of that are underleveraged in this country? And so, you know, what are the places like New Mexico, which I think is the ideal candidate to start this movement for this very reason, where there is a tremendous amount of R&D talent per capita, and there's a tremendous amount of strength in the research institutions, but there's perhaps maybe not as much commercialization happening. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that that thesis has proven true in our first 6 months at Roadrunner. We, having been at the labs, having partnered with the universities, having met with a lot of the scientists, there is a palpable hunger to create companies, to take core research insights, and also drive them to mean economic returns for the community. And there are tremendous things that could be converted into products in those labs. So that that kind of core insight that, you know, some places are just under leverage, and frankly, venture funds like ourselves, it behooves us to pay attention to them because the ROI is high and they're unsaturated markets. The second thing I think we've learned is that there is no substitution for being on the ground and being part of the community. Mm. You cannot fly in and out into a place like New Mexico or into a place like North Dakota or into a place like, you know, Montana, and expect to build the necessary community relationships in order to succeed. Every, you know, our vision is to build a national network of venture studios that are bespoke to every community they're born into. So New Mexico,
just understand this real quick. So Roadrunner then is the New Mexico iteration. Would there then be a different, is Roadrunner like a national brand, or is Roadrunner New Mexico specific?
Roadrunner is a national brand, and our first studio and our national headquarters is in New Mexico.
Okay.
And we are going to take that Roadrunner model and we're going to apply it to other places. And the key point of this, Marshall, as it relates to what I was saying, is it has to be threaded into that idiosyncrasy of that culture and of that community, because every community needs something different, right? In New Mexico, you're the home to Los Alamos and Sandia and Air Force Research Lab. The team we build, the services we provide, the focuses we have will look different than they might in Iowa. They'll look different than they might in New Jersey. And I think that's part of the magic, where I'm saying you can't just do this from Palo Alto or New York and fly in and out into Albuquerque or into Fargo, into wherever, and say, we're going to build something here. You really have to be a part of the community. I can remember when I first started this mission alongside America's Frontier Fund and others, I told everybody I was on a mission to do 1,000 coffee chats in 2 months, which meant doing nothing but listening. What's been missing here in New Mexico? What can we provide? How do we make sure the things that we provide are not redundant to what else is already happening in the community? What are the tensions? What are the ways that, you know, the tribes have been left behind? What are the ways that the community has been broken over certain years? What are the ways that Roadrunner can help, you know, I think, up level, but also bring the necessary capital and fill in the building blocks of the ecosystem that are missing? So the first is, you know, we do believe, and I think it's proven true, that ideas and amazing research insights are equally distributed. They're not just in the coasts, but it turns out opportunity is not. Two, you've got to be there. There's no substitution for being in the backyard, particularly if you want to partner genuinely with scientists. And then three, you need to have good partners locally. You have to identify, you know, either folks in the institutions, the research institutions or universities, but also at the state and local level. And we have found that in our experience in New Mexico, that's definitely been the case. So, you know, we partner closely with the local government in Albuquerque, and we've had a lot of great collaboration with the state government in New Mexico. And to my earlier point, creating research insights and turning them into products and actually creating new 10X companies, not incremental companies, is really, really hard. So our work is, as a studio, we always want to start on the 25-yard line and not on the goal line. And starting on the 25-yard line means finding the non-dilutive grant funding, finding the government partners that are willing to give you some support as you build new companies. And so that's not only for Roadrunner, where they've been immensely supportive and helpful, but also for all the companies we create. We want to keep them in New Mexico, right? We want to fight this flight to the coast where, you know, think about all the companies, particularly in New Mexico, that have been born there, but have left. And gosh, even Microsoft, right? How different would New Mexico look if some of those unicorns had stayed? Well, we want to make sure that by being there and by partnering with governments, that we make the case to all of our entrepreneurs, all of our portfolio companies, all aspiring scientists to build their companies and make sure they stay there and are successful there.
So this is so fascinating because having spoken with a lot of founders, what I've routinely heard from folks, and because you kind of ran this experiment with the remote work dynamic, a lot of founders I know have basically told the story of the past 3 years as follows. Launched a company, we went remote, it was really great, all these advantages, you could live anywhere, work anywhere. Very quickly, by year two or three, as we started to scale and get successful, not only our VCs were telling us we need to either go to New York, SF, LA, et cetera, or even like Miami in some contexts, but we were actually noticing at a talent level, at a hiring the proper engineers level, we just were getting all this pressure to move. So here we find ourselves in SF when that wasn't where we wanted to end up. What is your response to me as a founder basically telling that story as you think about keeping people there?
I think there's a few things I'd say. One is to say that COVID changed our concepts of work and managing teams. It also changed our concepts of where capital can be deployed and how we can necessarily build around those core founders. So I think what is possible today in 2023, frankly, was not possible in 2018. Mm-hmm. The Roadrunner model of building venture studios in communities where, you know, historically there's not been venture funds and or as much strategic capital would have been impossible in 2017, 2018. And I think today, you know, we are the right solution for this moment because I think it is more possible to create what I'll call, Marshall, maybe the kind of the virtual Silicon Valley for every region, right? So if we call Silicon Valley the, you know, let's take the components of it. It's an unbelievable network, right? Between funders and scientists and researchers and institutions. And again, it's you're a stone's throw away from a venture funder, and you're a stone's throw away from a subject matter expert in any emerging tech. That's actually hard to replicate in a lot of parts of the country. Two, there's capital. There's an abundance of capital. There are folks that are risk-facing, risk-leaning, and are willing to write early seed checks for concepts. And three, there's amazing, talented people, right, that come out of the institutions and that stay there. Well, I think if we take each of those components, today, replicating that model in different parts of the country is possible. One, a lot of talent has moved. Mm-hmm. That's just the reality. Look no further than what's happening in Santa Fe. Look no further than what's happening in places like Jackson Hole and in places like Iowa, where you're seeing communities of innovators and entrepreneurs that might've lived in New York, might've lived in Miami, might've lived in San Francisco and have said, actually, you know, the value proposition of living here for me and my family is better. Then what you're able to do is also, I think the network component is just easier. You and I probably wouldn't be having this conversation over Zoom in 2016. But now we're able to do all types of work and connect in ways, you know, supplemented by technologies that I think allow us to build teams, to invest in people, and to really do work together and collaborate together in ways that were really hard. So it turns out that, you know, we can have a founder that's in Albuquerque and have advisors that are in Palo Alto and venture investors in Miami. And it's actually not as uncomfortable, not as hard, and it is a lot more normalized. And then three, when you think about the network, I think the same component applies where, you know, there is an ability to work together easier over places like Zoom and WebEx and what have you. But also, you know, I think networks have changed in the way that we think about them. They are more decentralized. You know, there are institutions that are making the case to researchers and scientists from other places to come live there. The value proposition on where to live and where to work is just very different. And as we've talked to entrepreneurs, and I've even recruited for my own team at Roadrunner, making the pitch for New Mexico is actually pretty easy these days, right? Mm-hmm. Great cost of living, great outdoors, wonderful community. And I think we can extrapolate that to say there are things that are possible today that I think for a lot of founders that tried to do this five, 6 years ago, it was just a lot harder.
So last two or three serious ones before we close on something more about like your background and interests. I'm interested if this is an expanded national network and different states are going to have different studios pop up, why a Roadrunner? Because that feels very New Mexico. Because when I was first hearing about that, I was like, oh, because I grew up in Oregon. So I'm like, oh, there's going to be like the Beaver Studio, which isn't great. Like that's the, you know, state animal. But like, how do you think of how that convey? What does the term Roadrunner mean to someone in a state like Oregon or a place like Montana?
Like so many stories with startups and early concepts, you have an idea and it sticks, right? I even think about some of the naming of Apple and Nike and so on. So, you know, to say that we contemplated Roadrunner being a brand in and of itself at those early days would be an exaggeration, but I will say it's taken hold. And I think the reason why we chose it initially from a philosophical level is at least two things. One, Roadrunners are on the move and we wanted to show something very kinetic. We are going to be building quickly. We don't want to be a place that sort of over promises, moves into a community and takes 2 years to do anything. I mean, we have been really, really focused on making sure that we are on the move, that people know that we are serious and that this is kinetic. And that when we decide to build a Roadrunner somewhere, we're going to be developing companies quickly and returning economic returns to those communities quickly. This isn't a 20-year project. This is something where you can expect 3 to 4 companies a year coming out of us. And if we do our work right in New Mexico, we started our mission there in April and May, we should have 1 to 2 companies by end of year. And so I think that just kinetic image was important. The second is that, you know, my conceptualization of Roadrunners were they were always moving forward. You know, I've never seen a Roadrunner back up. And look, the challenge is hard. Building disruptive companies is hard in and of itself, but then deciding to go do that in a lot of regions in America and to partner with labs and scientists, this is new. It's unique. You know, we are throwing out to our earlier conversation, the playbook for a lot of software-based studios, and we're trying something new. But what we're going to do is we're going to continue to march forward. We're going to have to take a lot of risks, but we're in the business of taking them. And we're going to have to iterate. And yes, we're going to get things wrong, but we're going to keep learning. We're going to keep moving forward. And it starts in New Mexico and it moves forward from there to Oregon, to New Jersey, to where have you.
And last big question here. Love to hear your thoughts on like the CHIPS and Science Act 2022 legislation. Really, you're looking at this massive governmental effort at the federal level, working with state governments to kind of promote innovation systems. Love to hear your just like broader perception of the role that the federal government's going to play in these efforts.
You know, I applaud the U.S. government for thinking strategically and I think becoming quite hands-on about building a domestic industrial base. From a student of national security and foreign policy, and also somebody who's building a venture studio, the government needs to be involved, needs to be active in helping spur a lot of these industries. Again, because the stakes are very high and the implications of our success have large impacts on our geopolitical standing and I think our competitiveness as a country. I think the CHIPS Act, you know, it's been focused a lot on the kind of kickstarting the domestic semiconductor manufacturing industry. And I'll say that it's a good first step, right? It's a good first step for the government to help seed and support. But the United States can't just build fabs. You know, we have to grow every facet of the entire ecosystem for our country to thrive. That means, you know, investing in not only research, but product development, thinking through market fit, thinking through how do we manufacture at scale, thinking through how to build communities of talent. And, you know, I'll say Roadrunner is kind of partnering with the U.S. government to think about how to build those other blocks of the ecosystem around the financial support. And the last thing I'll say is a lot of these efforts have been targeted towards existing corporations and existing efforts, which again are important. But we also need to be doing a lot of the early invention and starting of new companies. You know, I live in this kind of pre-seed, seed concept stage of company development. And I encourage the government and, you know, hope to partner with them on finding ways to build new things, not just scale the existing. We need both. But if we do this right, the United States can build a capital supply chain from, again, research inside at the lab to folks that will help partner to de-risk technology so that it might live enough to see a Series A, through all the way to kind of IPO and scale, where hopefully the government can provide a variety of resources via the CHIPS money and IRA and otherwise to kind of scale existing efforts. But in order for us to be competitive, we have to build that capital supply chain. So just adding on and filling into the voids that I think CHIPS doesn't address, but hopefully places like Roadrunner can.
And, you know, let's close on this. The compliment I want to offer you is that you're kind of just the ideal person who I want the younger listeners to this podcast to really kind of look up to, in the sense that I speak to a lot of young people who are either in like the Goldman Sachs-y or like tech finance jobs, and they want to contribute. They think these issues are interesting, but they kind of feel like they're very tracked. You obviously are going from Goldman world to grad school to this space. I'd love to hear just like your broad advice for interested listeners who want to kind of escape that, the 2010s quote of like the greatest minds of our generation like went to go work in ad sales. Because I clearly think we're moving past that convention just being obvious and true. So advice for folks who want to kind of follow the path you've directionally followed.
I'll say that I think the, you know, first of all, I certainly don't have it all figured out and am learning along the way, and I'm learning from a lot of mentors and friends and colleagues at Roadrunner and other places. I was born in the kind of post 2008 paradigm, where I think the experience for a lot of folks graduating was student loans. And, you know, my experience is that there was a general flight to safety, if you will, that I think in my own personal experience of, you know, leaving college, I looked for the safest place to go. Where could I make sure that I could get a paycheck? Where could I make sure to help pay my student loans? Where could I, you know, start to build a career? And, you know, what I would urge people to think about is to fight that flight to safety. And I think that there are more ways to do it today than there were then. And that, you know, to create new things in the world, to build, anybody can be a builder. And maybe back to our earlier thoughts, building can be, you know, in any region. And I think that it can be not just private sector companies, but they can be ideas. And part of what I share with my own team and what I share with interns that come and join us is fighting that flight to safety and becoming a builder starts with having an opinion. And that means, you know, for so many years, I felt that I was quiet in meetings. You know, I didn't speak up as much. Again, on this kind of general thought of being risk adverse, I felt I was pretty risk adverse. And even in my kind of personal style to work. But my urge and my encouragement is to have a point of view on everything, not just the implications of the work, but can we do the work better? Is there another way to think about it? And speak up in meetings. You know, I think part of the tragedy of COVID, for all the gains and the ways that it's helped us think about virtual work and living in different regions and collaborating, I think that a lot of folks have suffered from lack of mentorship, and it is harder to get a voice in when you are just graduating, when you are just leaving grad school, and you're learning, and you also are developing your own voice and your own view. And sometimes it's harder to unmute the button and say it over VC than it is in a meeting or one-on-one with your boss having coffee. And I guess that I would state kind of on this broader theme is fight that flight to safety conceptually and what you do, you know, and but also personally and professionally and how you interact with people and you know, challenging yourself to have an opinion. I had an amazing mentor at Goldman when I was there, who she had what she called the donut rule. Could never go to a meeting with a customer and say nothing. And I try to kind of live that value today. I also try to bring that to all of our interns and folks that work with us, which is to say, have an opinion. Don't go into a meeting and say nothing. And for leaders, that means making sure we give them the space, making sure that I understand how challenging it is to get mentorship in a virtual era and to build virtual teams, but making sure we create the platforms for a whole host of people to have an opinion, to have a view, and to have their own set of ideas so that they might go create. Everybody in our company has a 30-60-10 rule. And the 10%, doesn't matter if you are an analyst, you know, or our office administrator or our head of talent. That 10% needs to be thinking about creating something new in whatever capacity it might be for you. But we have to give space for creativity. We have to give the platforms for people to build and hopefully help inspire a generation to build something new. Don't just, you know, follow the hordes of folks that leave school looking for safety like I did. And I hope that can be encouraging to folks that are listening and thinking about it.
That's awesome. And a great place to end the conversation. So Adam, where should folks, because y'all are launching very soon after this episode, where should folks go to learn more?
Well, we've got a website at roadrunnerventurestudios.com. We're having our public launch on December 5th. And, you know, folks can always email me at adam@roadrunnerventurestudios.com and share their ideas, their reactions. And again, we want to be that place that helps people take risks. So if you've got an amazing idea, we're in the ideas business. Share your great ideas, partner with us. We're here. And Marshall, I appreciate the opportunity to share some of my thoughts and to spend some time with you.
Totally. Thank you for joining me on The Realignment.
Thank you.
Hope you enjoyed this episode. If you learned something, like the sort of mission, or want to access our subscriber-exclusive Q&A, bonus episodes, and more, go to realignment.supercast.com and subscribe to our $5 a month, $50 a year, or $500 for lifetime membership rates. See you all next time.